Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you. With 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.
Welcome, dear listeners, to a special presentation of Macabre, a dark history podcast. We delve into the shadows of the past where history's most sinister tales reside. These are the stories that cannot be confined to a single episode, narratives that demand a deeper exploration and immersion into the human condition. Prepare to immerse yourself in accounts of chilling crimes, unsolved mysteries, and the darker side of human nature in this macabre feature. Episode 1, A Monster is Born, The Making of H.H. Holmes. Gilmanton, New Hampshire, a quiet place, a place where secrets settle into the soil like frost, where winters bite through old wood, and silence clings to the corners of every narrow lane. On May 16, 1861, in a simple farmhouse nestled among rocky hills, a baby boy entered the world. He was given the name Herman Webster Mudgett. But the world would later come to know him by a different name, a name that would echo throughout the years as America's first serial killer, H.H. Holmes. But before he became America's first documented serial killer, before the dark corridors of the three-story murder castle and the labyrinth of horrors in Chicago, Herman Webster Mudgett was just a boy shaped by hands both cruel and devout. Herman was the third of five children born to Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Price. The Mudgetts were a family of Old English stock, well-respected in their community, descended from early settlers who arrived with Puritan values that would shape New England for centuries. His father, Levi, was a strict Methodist, a temperance advocate, and a farmer by trade. He was also sometimes house painter and a postmaster, always seeking work to support his growing family. But the most enduring image of Levi was his stern presence. Levi was known for his heavy hand and his unyielding discipline. He believed that sparing the rod spoiled the child, and he wielded his authority like a scythe. It was said that Levi would punish his children for the smallest of infractions: a misplaced tool, a spilled glass of milk, a glance that lingered too long on the horizon instead of the work at hand. His mother, Theodate, was a figure carved from the same cold stone. Deeply religious, she often retreated into her faith with an intensity that bordered on fanaticism. She prayed over her children constantly, filling the farmhouse air with whispered supplications and warnings of hellfire. When Herman was afraid of the dark, of illness, of his father's rage, his mother didn't soothe him with children's lullabies or warm embraces. Instead, she prayed. She turned fear into a weapon, a tool to bend him towards righteousness, or what she believed righteousness to be. The walls of their home were rumored to be plastered with handwritten Bible verses, a reminder that sin was ever present and that God's watchful eyes never closed. From a young age, Herman was different. Neighbors noted how still he was, how his large, pale blue eyes seemed to absorb everything around him. One of his eyes was afflicted with strabismus, a condition which prevented his eyes from aligning, known at the time as a turn of the eye. It is believed that this affliction might have isolated Herman in early childhood from his peers because he couldn't look them directly in the eye. Herman was a loner. While other children roughhoused and hunted frogs, Herman observed their actions, and sometimes he watched a little too closely. Stories began to circulate about the young boy who lured small animals into the woods and returned alone. His clothes oddly tidy, his expression unreadable. Soon after, bones would be found, small, delicate bones, cleaned of their flesh, hidden in crates or beneath the floorboards of his home. But no one seemed to care about what we would now view as a precursor to more sinister behavior, the common characteristics that define the early makings of a serial killer. There's no record of anyone confronting Herman about this behavior. In those days, children's oddities were often dismissed as passing phases or left to the iron will of the father to correct. But for Herman, it was more than just a phase. It was the beginning of an obsession. There's one story about Herman's childhood that stands out among the local lore. When Herman was around 10, he went exploring with a friend in an old abandoned farmhouse on the outskirts of Gilmanton, the kind of place children dared each other to enter. A forbidden location with floorboards half rotted, staircases missing entire steps, air thick with dust, the ghosts of harvest long past. It is whispered that Herman's friend never made it out of the abandoned building alive. The official story called it a tragic accident. The boy had fallen from a high beam and broken his neck. A heartbreaking but not unheard of fate in rural New England. But whispers in Gilmanton told another version. Some said Herman had led the boy up to the rafters, urging him to look out a window at the fields below. Others claimed Herman was the last one seen near the boy, his pale face expressionless as the body was discovered. Whether or not he was pushed, whether or not it was a true murder or an accident, we may never know. But for those who knew young Herman, this event planted an irreversible seed of suspicion. Then came the incident that changed everything, the skeleton incident. Herman had always harbored a deep fear of doctors and anything associated with death, as most children do. Perhaps it was the tales his mother told of eternal damnation or the terror that followed Levi's harsh punishments. One day, a group of older boys decided to play a cruel prank on Herman. They knew he was afraid. They dragged him, protesting and terrified, into the office of a local doctor. In the center of that sterile room stood a human skeleton, its bones yellowed and its skull tilted as if forever laughing at the living. The boys expected to see Herman collapse in tears and scream in terror, but instead, he fell silent. What he did next shocked the very boys who meant to torment him. Herman stepped forward, raised his hand, and touched the skeleton's bony fingers. A quiet curiosity marked his countenance. With his fingertips steady, he began to trace the lines, the joints, the hollows of the rib cage, with a fascination so intense that it unsettled the other boys. They fled in horror, leaving Herman alone with his new muse. In that moment, Herman's fear was diminished, and a new obsession was born. He would later describe this encounter as a revelation and the very point at which death ceased to be an abstract punishment or a ghostly threat, and instead became an object of study, something to be controlled, dissected, and understood. After that incident, Herman began to change. He spent more time alone in the woods, meticulously dissecting frogs and small mammals. He preserved the bones, experimented with boiling methods, learned to skin and deflesh specimens with the precision of a surgeon. He wasn't merely killing for sport. He was learning. Teachers noted his sharp intelligence. He excelled at school, especially in subjects like mathematics and science. But he had few friends. He was too precise, too watchful. One schoolmate would later describe him as oddly polite, yet cold behind the eyes. At home, things were no better. Levi's punishments became harsher as Herman grew older and more defiant. He learned to mask his emotions to protect himself by manipulating the adults around him. In this, he realized something critical. Control equals survival. Manipulation equals power. And those lessons stayed with him long after he left the small town of Gilmanton. In 1877, at the age of 16, Herman enrolled in Phillips Exeter Academy, one of the most prestigious preparatory schools in New England. His family saw this as a chance for him to escape his rural roots and build a respectable future. But Exeter was no less isolating for young Herman. Wealthy classmates mocked him for his rural background and odd demeanor. It was here he first began to experiment with his charm, his ability to convince and to perform, because he had to in order to survive. Despite the teasing, he excelled academically and set his sights on the future. He would study medicine. But before he went off to medical school, at the age of just 17, he married Clara Lovering, the daughter of a local New Hampshire farmer. Clara was described as sweet, trusting, and perhaps a little naive. Within a year, she gave birth to their son, Robert Lovering Mudgett. But fatherhood did not ground Herman. Instead, it seemed to spur him further towards escape. Like a rat caught in a trap, in 1879, he was ready to leave everything, Clara, his infant son, and his past behind. It was then that he set his sights on medical school. He left New Hampshire and entered the University of Vermont in Burlington to study medicine. But he found the environment lacking for his desires for an extensive education and soon transferred to the University of Michigan's Department of Medicine and Surgery in 1882. The University of Michigan was, at the time, one of the country's top medical schools. Here, Herman found his true calling. The study of anatomy, dissection labs filled with the smell of formaldehyde, and the quiet horror of cadaver eyes staring blankly at the ceiling. But for Herman, these rooms were not frightening. They were liberating. Here, death was not to be feared, but wielded. He began to understand the fragility of the human body and the many ways it could be dismantled, altered, repurposed. He also discovered an even more profitable application of his new skills, insurance fraud. And so his list of criminal offenses began to grow. During this time, he started stealing cadavers from the university lab. After all, cadavers were in high demand at competing medical schools. Surely, no one would miss a cadaver or two. He saw this as an opportunity for profit, but he was no fool. He would mutilate the corpses to make identification impossible and then stage them as accident victims in an elaborate insurance scam. He'd take out policies on fictional identities, then collect the insurance money upon their deaths. The payoffs were substantial enough to fund his growing appetite for luxury, fine suits, lavish dinners, and expensive travel. Outwardly, he was a dedicated student, a young man with a bright future who charmed his fellow classmates and professors. But beneath that shiny veneer lurked a manipulator who was simply honing his craft. But he did not excel at his home life. His relationship with Clara deteriorated. She and their son moved back to New Hampshire, and Holmes severed all contact, leaving his wife emotionally and financially stranded. He was now free to pursue new romantic entanglements. Holmes discovered he could weaponize charm as easily as he wielded a scalpel. It was during his time in Michigan that he perfected the art of forging documents, death certificates, letters of introduction, insurance paperwork. He could create them all, and often did. Holmes also learned to read people, to sense when a lie would land and when it would collapse. These skills would become his deadliest tools. He wasn't content to simply defraud companies or skip out on debts. He was practicing something deeper, seeing how far he could push the boundaries of deception before the world pushed back. By the time he graduated in 1884, Herman Webster Mudgett had already become someone else entirely. His birth name was too plain, too rural, too vulnerable. It was then that he adopted a new identity, Dr. Henry Howard Holmes. Under this name, he would enter Chicago, a city pushing with ambition and vice, and transform it into his personal hunting ground. Behind him, he left a trail of unpaid bills, broken hearts, and vanished acquaintances. But no one pursued him too far. He was always charming, always moving, always changing. Wherever he went, there was a pattern, a missing person, a fraudulent insurance claim, a new alias. The man who left New Hampshire as a haunted boy had become a man wholly devoted to his own advancement, whatever the cost. Before he was a monster, he was just a boy molded by cruelty and obsession. Before he built his castle of horrors, he built himself. A child born in frost and Bible verses. A young man who learned to love the smell of formaldehyde more than the warmth of a family hearth. And when he boarded that train bound for Chicago, he wasn't just searching for fortune. He was searching for a kingdom. A kingdom where he could reign as judge, jailer, and executioner. And so he set his sights on the bustling streets of Chicago, a city unprepared for the horror he would bring. The devil had found his playground. Next time on Macabre, we follow Holmes to the Windy City. We watch as the blueprints form and walls rise. We witness the creation of a place so monstrous it will become known as the Murder Castle. I do hope you join me for the next episode. This has been a special presentation, a Macabre feature. Until next time, stay safe, stay curious, and keep it macabre.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.